Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Lenio and I represent Dennis Wooden. Mr. Wooden entered into a conditional plea agreement preserving his right to appeal the trial court's denial of his motion to suppress evidence. That is the sole issue on this appeal. On January 27, 2007, Mr. Wooden and a female companion were walking down Miami Street in South Bend, Indiana at approximately 8:10 a.m. They entered into a 7-Eleven store, purchased several snack food items, and then walked west down Milton Street, which is a side street to the 7-Eleven. After walking approximately one block, Wooden and his companion were stopped by Officer Reynolds, a South Bend police officer, at gunpoint, and were told by Officer Reynolds to raise their hands. Both Wooden and his companion, Renee Horvath, complied with that request. Within another minute or so, another South Bend officer Gibbons, arrived at the scene. Both Wooden and Horvath were held at gunpoint initially, then were told to drop to the ground, lay in the street, where they laid in the street while the police conducted their investigation.
But Mr. Lenio, I mean, as I understood the essence of your argument, it was that this person standing by the phone booth at the Instant Lube who called in to 911, your argument, as I understand it, is that he really wasn't in a position to see what was going on at the 7-Eleven a few blocks down the street. According to Google Maps, it looks like it's about 2.5 blocks or so.
Right.
But you may be taking too literal a view of it. Somebody who knows the area might know that at that point the parking lot leads into a 7-Eleven. The rules for 911 calls have been different from other kinds of reports to police, and this caller is reporting some ongoing activity. Doesn't that make a difference?
In this particular case, I think what's important is if you look at the transcript of the 911 call, the anonymous caller is, in fact, giving a recitation of events which he says he is actually seeing.
Right.
And he says that he can see, you know, these people actually walking into the store. And there's literally no possible way that he could have seen that because the store is set back
so there's a parking lot in front of the store, sure. You know, that's not unusual.
And I think that based upon the totality of the circumstances here, when you consider what he has reported in the 911 call, that any examination of those circumstances would see that he could not actually report what he says in that 911 call.
How are the police supposed to know that, by the way? They get the call. He's reporting, you know, that a gun is in evidence. He's reporting some hostile activity. The 7-Eleven is, in fact, down the street from the Instant Lube.
Right.
Any police officer who knows the area would probably know that. What kind of burden are you anticipating on the police officers? They should just kind of sit around when 911 calls come in and pull up the maps, or
no.
What?
Certainly this area where this event occurred was well known to the officer. The officer had patrolled this particular
area.
I would say it's more of a high crime area after dark. This was 8:10 in the morning, I think, on a Saturday morning. So the circumstances here were the officer obviously was familiar with this particular area. He turns on to Miami Street, glances over at the payphone in the parking lot of the Instant Lube, sees no one there, proceeds down to the 7-Eleven where he sees Mr. Wooden and his companion walking down the side street.
I think sounds like corroboration to me, actually, that he sees that before he pulls them over and they meet the description of the 911 report.
Well, what the fact that he sees them, I think one further fact is pertinent to our inquiry in this case, and that is prior to Wooden and his companion knowing he's there, he observes them for a period of time. He observes them walk down the block. What he sees is not information that corroborates the 911 call. What he sees them doing is walking down the street, being lawfully abiding the law, eating some snack food that they bought at 7-Eleven. And then once the officer confronts them, the immediate response is they're held at gunpoint. They're then asked to drop to the ground. They are compliant in everything that's requested. We don't see any suspicious behavior, any movements by either Ms. Horvath or Mr. Wooden, which would cause the officers concern for their safety.
But the report said he had a gun.
But the fact that he had a gun and it does not give a right just to stop anybody on the street. I mean, the information that was received was that there was some type of an emergency.
That there was an emergency in that person's mind.
In that person
made the emergency call.
Right.
Isn't that to be given credence?
Well,
under the law.
Under the law, I think it needs to be considered in the context of the cases like JL, which mention the situation where someone can be a victim of some type of enemy or someone who doesn't like them, someone who's trying to pick on them.
Well, that's
and
right.
That's exactly what happened in this particular case.
So the question is here, what distinguishes this from the situation the Supreme Court was worried about in JL, you know, where, you know, I look out the window and I see somebody I don't like standing on the corner and I call up the police and say there's a person wearing a red shirt on the corner who has a gun in his pocket, and I just make this up. I'm just saying that. And sure enough, they see a person wearing a red shirt in the corner. But they don't know anything about me. I've just called. So what changes? Why is this case like that when there are, in fact, other things such as the distance from the instant lube to the 7-Eleven, which actually strikes me as not really that far, and the people matching the description?
Well, the difference is, I think, in the totality of the circumstances, it was not a situation where the so-called anonymous caller could have in fact seen these events. I mean, if we went outside,
the presumption is that the call is reliable. Isn't that the presumption in the law?
Yes, but if we take that as basically a wholesale argument that anytime someone calls 911,
nobody said that was the fact. No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
Nor does the case law.
Right. There are exceptions to that presumption.
Is the point I'm making? One of those exceptions.
And I'm saying that this is one of those exceptions because the police officer's own investigation did not verify that there was in fact an emergency, and the conduct of both Mr. Wooden and Ms. Horvath after they were confronted by the police would not lead to any indication that there was an emergency. In fact, Ms. Horvath was asked by the police, "Is there any type of disturbance? Is there a problem?" And she answered, "No, there was not." Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, Mr. Barrett.
May it please the court, Jesse Barrett of the United States. I think that going back to one of the questions Judge Wood asked, which is what should the officers have done here? were the court to agree with Mr. Lenio, essentially there would be no way for officers to investigate a report of an emergency 911 call while also protecting themselves. Here, officers responded immediately to the call, getting to the scene within 3 minutes after the call was made. They first went to the location from which it was reported to them by dispatch that the call came. They confirmed, obviously, if there was somebody there, like the 911 caller, they would have spoken to him, but he wasn't there. So what they did was confirm that a caller reporting a couple walking down the street towards the 7-Eleven, they confirmed that he would have been able to view that he would have been able to view a gun being brandished. And then after they confirmed that, they went to the 7-Eleven to see if the couple was there. The couple was not there, but they observed a couple matching the description walking within a half block away from the 7-Eleven.
So how is this case different, though, from JL? I mean, it's awfully close to JL.
There are similarities, but I think the differences are more glaring. The main difference is that the caller reported an emergency.
So if the caller says, I think this is an emergency, that takes any case out of JL?
Well, the police didn't take the caller's word for it that this is an emergency. The police themselves viewed this as an emergency.
So they didn't see any emergency-like behavior. They didn't see a fist fight in the 7-Eleven parking lot. They didn't see her running down the street with him in hot pursuit. There certainly was nothing to the naked eye by the time the police got there to suggest emergency. Now, certainly, I consider it quite possible that the caller was reporting an emergency. That's what domestic violence is sometimes like. Maybe he threatened her with the gun and she shut up and was behaving herself at that point.
It is certainly true the officers did not observe anything that looked like an emergency. What they did, however, was corroborate all the information they could corroborate from the caller.
Sounds to me, though, like the rule of law is that because you could corroborate in those ways in JL as well. So it sounds like, as a matter of law, the distinction is when the 911 caller says, I am reporting something that I am looking at with my own eyes right now and I think it's an emergency, that's enough to take the case out of the JL rule.
Well, the officers, there was information in this case that wasn't.
So why don't you want to say that? You don't.
Well, I mean, let's see. I think that's true, but I think
all
there's
right.
more. I think there's also more than that.
Right.
In JL, the court points out there was no way to know, you know, when the call was placed, how long it took the officers to get there. Here, we do know how long it took, and we know that it was immediate. In JL, there was no information on how the caller acquired the information. Here, there was that information. In JL, there was no corroboration of anything besides the fact that an individual matching the description was at the location. Here, there was corroboration of where the call was placed from, what the caller could have observed, and corroboration that that couple had, in fact, been at the 7-Eleven. So I think there's, while the rule of law that you state, I think, is an accurate one, I think there is also even more here to sort of take us even beyond that rule of law and to distinguish it on its face from JL. But certainly, this court's clear holding in Drake was the presumption of reliability attaching to an emergency 911 call. It is certainly true that in Drake, the caller did identify himself, but the Seventh Circuit...
And we placed some weight on that. We
right.
said if people are willing to be accountable and the police know your name, maybe you're a little less likely to fabricate things.
Right. So I think that is a factor in the totality of the circumstances analysis. I would point out that the two decisions that Drake relied on, the Second Circuit case and the Eleventh Circuit case, both involved anonymous calls.
I don't understand what an anonymous call is. I mean, suppose the caller claimed to be a 15-and-a-half-year-old woman by the name of, right, and here insert, I mean, you were here for the last case.
Blondie.
The blonde DT, it was completely phony, mm-hmm. right? People give phony names to police all the time. In fact, they give phony names to police even after they're arrested. Why should we think that anything turns on whether a name was given unless we know the name was truthful? And we also have the person's fingerprints on file. Now, of course, this may be a problem with JL. The Supreme Court seemed very credulous in thinking that if somebody gives a name to the police, the name must be the true name.
Let's see. The courts have recognized at least different levels of anonymity. So I think there has been some recognition in the case law that anonymous isn't a clear yes or no. In fact, one of the things that Justice Kennedy talked about in his concurrence to JL was that some anonymity could be lost by, for example, if you were able to trace the call back to the phone from which it was placed. Here, you know, for what it's worth, the caller was never asked to identify himself, you know, query whether he really wanted to remain anonymous or just didn't get to that point. His anonymity here was compromised to a certain extent because police did know where he was calling from, so if police had gotten there even a minute quicker, they could well have discovered him at the location from which he was placing the call. So I agree that the anonymity analysis is more complicated than the JL court seemed to make it. But I think it's a relevant inquiry. I mean, certainly if a caller refuses to give his name as opposed to not being asked to give his name, you know, that could be a factor in the totality of the circumstances test.
Or if the caller walks into the police or comes into the police station and says, I need to report something to you, and there he or she is. I mean, there are degrees, as you
right,
say.
Right. And I would say that the degree of anonymity in this case isn't as far as it was in JL, although admittedly it's not a carbon copy of Drake. I mean, they in fact didn't have his name. But I think a way to analyze the case is to come back to what should the officers have done. So under Mr. Lenio's analysis, should they have approached the couple without their guns being drawn, knowing that there was a reasonable likelihood that Mr. Wooden might have been armed and thereby put themselves in harm's way? Should they not have responded at all? You know, once they watched the couple walk and they didn't see an argument, should they just have let them go, even though they received a tip that he was brandishing a weapon at her? I mean, it's not clear what a more appropriate response by officers would have been. I mean, so I would submit what they did here was, in fact, about as reasonable as it could be to Mr. Wooden's rights, by responding immediately, attempting to corroborate the information, you know, making sure that they had matched the right couple with the call, recognizing that they were in a high crime area and that there was a real danger of violence. So this court and other courts have expressed concern with, you know, we need to keep the officers safe and we need to trust their judgment. Here there's more than a half century of experience in this part of the South Bend. So I think it's important to give some deference, as the courts have recognized, to what they did. And then finally, I think it's also important to note that we cite the Huebner case in here. While officers weren't able to observe the gun or the emergency conduct, they were able to corroborate other aspects of what the caller had said. And as the court stated in Huebner, being able to corroborate some aspects, even innocent aspects, can give more reliability to the aspects that they weren't able to confirm, such as the possession of the gun. So if there are no questions, I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Anything further, Mr. Lenio?
A couple of comments, Your Honor.
In the government's argument, Mr. Barrett indicated that the police officer, prior to going down to the 7-Eleven, did confirm that a person could see down to the 7-Eleven. That is not supported by the record in this case. The particular street that the officer was on was Indiana Street, which tees into Miami Street. He immediately turned right. The instant lube was approximately half a block to the left where he didn't actually drive right by the instant lube. It was visible at the T intersection. He could see that no one was at that instant lube. So it wasn't actually confirmed by the officer prior to confronting Mr. Wooden and Ms. Horvath that the officer could have, in fact, seen the activities down at the incident loop. Officer Reynolds also acknowledged in his testimony on page 46 of the transcript that he was not thinking about the reliability of the information of the 911 caller, which I think is pertinent. And Reynolds also had testified at the suppression hearing that...
Counsel.
Thank you.
And counsel, we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your client as well as to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.